Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff. I'm here with Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer.
Hey, guys.
Hey, Evan.
Welcome back.
Hey, I feel like I forgot to say, I usually try to say where we're from. I'm from Atavist and you're from Longform.
Yeah, you're good about doing that.
There we go.
Who'd you talk to this week, Aaron?
This week, Nicholas Schmidl from The New Yorker, author of some of my favorite stories for the last few years, all around intrepid reporter. Pretty good moment. We're in our new space here, which is beautiful, but we have not lit it yet. So there's like a lone naked light bulb hanging up there directly over where the person being interviewed sits. And in the middle of the interview, when I was asking him about his sources for the Bin Laden piece he did, there was this like sweat pouring down his face. And I thought I really had shooken him up.
He almost gave up his sources.
Yeah, at the very end of the interview, he's like, yeah, it's nice in here. It's really hot. Very, very hot. but it was a great interview. I really appreciate it. He came in on short notice. And if you need to send an email newsletter on short notice, you should check out the good people at MailChimp's Tiny Letter. Simple, powerful way to send an email newsletter. Take it away from myself to the place. Welcome, Nicholas Schmidl. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
Sort of the first thing I want to talk about was you have a story this month in New Yorker called In the Crosshairs, which is really the story of two soldiers, one of whom a very decorated sniper and the other soldier who ended up killing him. What were the soldiers' names?
Eddie Ray Routh and Chris Kyle. Chris Kyle is the SEAL sniper.
And Chris Kyle is obviously was a very well-known figure who had written this hit book and was sort of pushed into pop culture as a sort of a super sniper. And this story was very widely reported as a news event when it happened. At what point did you decide you were going to do this story?
So the night of the murders, I was with one of my wife's friends' engagement parties, and I remember seeing the news come through and thinking, you know, that's probably a big story, but it also felt like the kind of story that every single men's magazine was going to be all over.
Yes.
And I thought, you know, this isn't some A, I just don't, it is, there is potentially a great story there, but I don't know how you could do it this quick, and I don't know how... I don't want to be the one that's knocking on Chris Kyle's wife's door 4 days after the murder and saying, you know, will you talk to me? So so that was on Saturday night, sort of Sunday. And, of course, on Monday or Tuesday, my editor at the magazine, Daniel Zaleski, said that David Remnick was interested in the story and wanted to know if I would take a crack at it. So I thought, all right, well, let me think about it for a couple of days. And actually, that following Monday was Chris Kyle's memorial service. And so I wanted to go to Texas and get a sense of just to see the memorial service and potentially knock on a few doors and see if there was anything there. And I went down there, and actually for the first month and a half that I was reporting the story, maybe even 2 months in, I was just drawing blanks and I had nothing. I had no one on the record. I mean, I had a couple of people who Chris Kyle had mentored on the record, but I really had nothing from Eddie's side. I mean, so I made 4 trips to Texas. And I think it was on the second trip that I was coming up with nothing. And I called my editor and just sort of was telling him by way of looking for an out, looking for him to say, okay, well, what was that other story you wanted to do? Go ahead and do that. And as I was telling him all this stuff that I was finding out about Chris Kyle, some of the stories of which appear in the magazine, the story about the gas station incident, the story about Hurricane Katrina, these unconfirmable sensational stories, everyone at the magazine was very excited and said, you know, God, you're on the right path. Keep pushing, keep pushing.
Because you saw that those stories were potentially bunk.
Yeah, because they seemed, yeah.
For people who haven't read the story, there was stories that were circulating pretty widely that he had claimed to have disarmed and killed two people who were robbing him of his truck and had killed rioters during Hurricane Katrina from the dome of the Superdome,
yeah,
on the top.
Yeah.
And while you were chasing these stories about Chris Kyle, were you simultaneously chasing the Routh story?
I was. So I made sort of a full court press on the Rouths from day one. I was sending them letters via FedEx, both the mother and the husband, and as well as Eddie's sister. Eddie's sister got back to me right away and told me that she had a long list of media organizations that had already contacted her, and that she'd put my name on the list, and that when the time came, she might call. And so I thought, oh man, so how am I going to be able to separate myself? So I, when I was down in Texas, I dropped off some flowers at her house, and just, you know, with a small note and with one of the back issues that included the Bin Laden story that I wrote for the magazine a couple of years ago. And there was a note that just said, you know, I know you're going through a lot, and maybe this will brighten your day or something. And when I reached out a couple of days later, you know, she came back. She, you know, they didn't know how to deal with, they didn't have any sort of media training. They weren't, you know, prepared for this. And she came back and said, you know, I don't know what I think about people leaving gestures. Like, I don't know if I appreciate gestures like that.
Oof.
So I thought, all right, well, that's not, I'm setting myself apart from the crowd, but not in a good way. And then I just continued to knock on doors of people that were friends and colleagues of the mother in particular. I knocked on one door of the mother's best friend and Eddie's godmother. And she came to the door and told me that she, you know, the minute I introduced myself, she shut the door in my face. So I got back in the car, and her boyfriend, husband, you know, male partner was behind her, kind of growling and scowling the whole time. And I left the house and I drove around for a little while, and I thought, okay, I need to go back with like a 5-second pitch, knowing that the door was going to get shut in my face again, but sort of leveraged the fact that I had actually already talked to Eddie and that I was trying to do this very, you know, I really just wanted to understand a little bit more about Eddie's background. And I went back the second time, I knocked, same number of cars were in the parking lot. I knocked, no one came to the door. I thought, all right, well, they're in here. They clearly just don't want to open the door. Knocked again. She didn't open the door this time, but the husband did. And he said, if you don't get off my property right now, I'm going to whip your ass. He started coming towards me. And I thought, all right, no, I feel like I'm exhausting all possible options.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, so I was doing this simultaneous to reporting out kind of the Chris Kyle side of things as well.
Yeah. Which I imagine that, as sort of a war hero, people were more interested in sort of preserving his legacy and talking about him. Routh is at least before the story, sort of the villain of the story. The story ends up, I would say, being pretty empathetic towards both parties and framing it as something of a tragedy. But, you said you had talked to Routh. He was willing to talk to you from prison?
So he called. I say again, send him a note and sort of, I don't know what the FedEx, I don't know what the FedEx account looks like for the past few months, but I was sending Eddie a lot of notes. Every few days I would send him a note. And he reached back to me about a few days after the funeral. Essentially, he probably reached out to me 10 days after the murders. And first I got a letter from him on a Friday that said he needed to get out of this box and, you know, he wanted to go out back and help the world. And it was short. It was like 2 or 3 lines written in pencil. Very cryptic, though. Tons of spelling errors. I mean, in fact, some words that just didn't even make sense. And later on, his girlfriend would tell me that he was dyslexic, and mother would say that he had a reading problem. But nonetheless, so then he called the next day. We spoke for about 10 minutes. He had the phone records would only let him make 15-minute calls, and his card just ran out. And he called, and he said that, you know, we talked a little bit and introduced myself, and we talked a little bit, very, very briefly about his time in Iraq, and then set up a return call. He said, you know, I'll call you on Monday, and we can talk as long as you want. And I said, okay, I'll put money on your card. And I didn't hear from him again. So I had these two very brief exchanges at the outset, which were helpful in going to the family that he had sort of wanted to reach out, but that was the extent. They weren't overly revealing.
Would you say your beat at the New Yorker is the U.S. military?
No, in fact, that was part of my reluctance to take the story on. Is that I said I don't want to be the SEAL guy. I don't want to be the military guy. I mean, the first story that I pitched to the magazine that the magazine commissioned was a piece that I wrote about a court martial.
Yeah.
And that I thought was just, it delved into this very sticky legal question that more or less allowed the military to try one man 3 times for murder, for a single crime. And while I was reporting that, I had lunch with someone, an old contact who seemed like he could be very helpful in guiding me on the Bin Laden story. So I picked that one up. I think that the SEAL story, I think that the reason why everyone there thought it was a good idea, it was because I had done the Bin Laden story. And so, well, you've got SEAL contacts and, you know, you come from a Marine family. So, you know, you can kind of leverage both of those two things to get both sides to talk. But I don't, I'm not interested in working the U.S. military beat.
All right. So whether you are or not on the U.S. military beat remains debatable. But you've written several stories about that have had a... had to deal with a lot of people who are active or former military servicemen. And I imagine that coming from a magazine like The New Yorker, a great asset if you're trying to profile a novelist, possibly not so much when you're dealing with people in the Navy. What are the sort of reactions you get when you approach people?
Well, particularly for this most recent story, just nothing. I mean, The New Yorker just doesn't register as... there's no cachet. And in fact, it kind of just suggests sort of East Coast elitism. And I mean, the lawyers for Eddie, one of the lawyers in particular, I mean, I would call and leave 15, 20 messages at the front desk, emails at home, FedEx letters to the house, and not get a response back. And you know, and then when I finally would hear from him, I'd be like, well, I've been really busy. And I think, you know, in New York, you can, or in DC, you can get very, very, very busy people to return a call just by mentioning you're with the New Yorker. It just didn't, it meant very little. And so that was, you know, it was good. It was fun. It sort of made it actually extra challenging. And in turn, when I eventually did get to the people that animate the story, the people that Chris Kyle did mentor and to the Routh family, I mean, there was no varnish of PR strategizing or anything. I mean, these were just, you know, very straightforward people, very straightforward conversations. And in that sense, I think it was very, you know, it was very rewarding as a reporting experience.
How did you represent your intentions with the story to them?
I think all along it was that I knew that there were additional sides to both Chris Kyle and to Eddie Ray Routh. And you know, I had gotten an inkling from the beginning that Eddie had had a number of run-ins or sort of had gone in and out of the VA system. And so that was my appeal to both the sister and the mother and father, was that I wanted to hear more about this. And with Chris Kyle's side, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the people, you would think that the people closest to him would be the most willing to talk. But his legacy right now is solid. His legacy is this infallible war hero.
And he's still on the bestseller list.
Still on the bestseller list. His newest book came out yesterday and on Tuesday morning. On Tuesday morning it was number 92 on Amazon, and by 5 when I checked again it was 19. I'm sure it's, you know, top 10-ish now. So, and he's just, you know, 8,000 people showed up to his memorial service in Cowboy Stadium. Apparently it was the longest funeral procession in the history of Texas. So I think the people closest to him thought that talking to a magazine like The New Yorker was going to do nothing to help burnish his reputation and legacy. So rather just stay away. So, but eventually I think that I made it clear that what I wanted to do was just that Chris Kyle as the infallible war hero, couldn't have been the whole story, and kind of, I wanted to capture the dips of him coming home and the difficulties he had in adjusting.
How did you learn the level of persistence to which you're able to send, say, 20 FedEx packages to someone? I mean, is that something that you've always had, or something you developed as a writer?
I think developed, and I think that something certainly at The New Yorker as well. Knowing that the expectation from editors is that you're not going to, you haven't quit until you've exhausted every option and the story is out and in print.
Yeah.
And so I think that with that sort of pinging around in the back of my head and having not been at the magazine very long, I just figured that I would kind of knock on every possible door.
And let's talk a little bit about how you got to a place where you are. It seems like the first stuff you started writing was while you were in Pakistan in around 2004.
Yeah.
What was your course that brought you to living in Pakistan?
Yeah, so I spent the summer of 2004 actually in Tehran studying Persian at Tehran University. I had started a grad program at American University, and a professor of ours said that, you know, if anyone wants to study Farsi this summer, she could probably make arrangements to get people into the country.
That offer is not still valid.
That offer is not still valid, as I would actually, as I would learn a couple of years later. So I went for the summer and lived in the dormitories with the student. I mean, it was just an incredible, incredible summer. And wrote a few pieces, travel piece, an op-ed or two, and then a feature-ish piece about the student movement. And took those pieces and leveraged them and got a small travel grant to go and spend 2 months in Central Asia and Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. I was just kind of looking for, I mean, Iran is not obscure, but looking for underreported places. And just, you know, Robert Kaplan, in a conversation very early on in 2004, 2005, you know, I had asked him what his approach was, and he said something about to find obscure places and tell people why they shouldn't be obscure.
What were you getting a graduate degree in?
International Affairs.
International Affairs. And what sort of led to that interest for you?
Putzing around and trying to become a philosopher. So my undergrad was in philosophy, and I started a grad program at Loyola University in Chicago, and spent a semester at Loyola, and just decided that this wasn't the financial and life investment that I wanted to make to become to spend 5 or 6 years paying to become a philosopher.
So you said that you came from a military family.
Yeah.
Were you moving around a lot, or?
We did. Yeah. I mean, well, we not internationally. We sort of bounced between. I was born in Arizona. My dad is an F-18 pilot. And so there were a couple of air bases, but I grew up mostly in Beaufort, South Carolina, but kind of bounced between there and Northern Virginia and Arizona as I was growing up, and then lived for the past 10 or so, maybe even longer, 15 years, more or less, in Northern Virginia and in D.C., which is default home by this point.
Did you consider joining the military yourself?
I thought about it, I think. I mean, and particularly after I came back from Iran, and when I was in grad school, I kind of thought about what approach to looking at these issues and kind of looking at world affairs and, you know, what approach did I want to take that with a 9mm or with a pen. I mean, not to oversimplify things. And, yeah. And I, when I came back from Iran, I had a really interesting conversation with a former Delta Force operator, and I told him what I was up to in Iran. And he said to me over beers one night that, you know, he said, I in recent years have also done similar things, you know, going into mosques where you're not supposed to be and kind of meeting, you know, going places, essentially being in places where you don't think that you're supposed to be, he said. But it took me a long time, you know, like I had to go through boot camp and do a bunch of crap. And so if you're already doing that now and you want to be doing that, then just skip the whole thing. Just like, you don't need to go into the military to do that.
And I think that urge to be somewhere where you're not supposed to be is a kind of a universal human urge. Once you had sort of crossed that threshold and you had gone to Tehran and you had gone to Central Asia, how did you start to translate those experiences into journalism?
Yeah. So in each time, I mean, each time was kind of, I had a mentor of sorts. I mean, Douglas McRae, who's the brains behind Pop Up out in San Francisco, was working at Foreign Policy at the time. And, I knew somebody who worked at like a real magazine. And so I would send Doug pitches and ideas, and he would kind of say like, this sounds like a research project, not as much like a magazine idea,
yeah.
But here are some things. And yeah. So I just started trying to write for anywhere that would take me and kind of trying to leverage each piece upon the other. So fast forward a few years, I applied for this fellowship to go spend 2 years in Iran studying, I wanted to look at identity politics in Iran. And a week after I got the fellowship was when Ahmadinejad was elected. And suddenly all of my reformist contacts who had been so helpful in getting me into, you know, meeting Grand Ayatollahs in Qom, et cetera, were now being branded as infidels and kind of, you know, we're not in a good spot.
They were like, maybe I could come stay with you.
Yeah. Eventually, after 4 or 5 months, the Iranian interest section, who were very helpful, the individuals there were very helpful to me getting in summer of 2004, just said, you're never going to get a visa. You and your wife are not going to get a 2-year visa to go like bounce around.
You were trying to go with your wife?
Yeah.
Wow. That's bold.
Yeah. So I just, right after I got the fellowship, when we thought we were going to do this, I proposed. I said, you know, we've been together for a long time, but they're gonna want to see a marriage certificate to go into hotels together. So let's make this official.
I like you made like going to Iran for 2 years of marriage like a package deal.
Well, when I asked her dad if I could marry her, we were out fishing he lives in Long Beach Island, and we were out fishing. And his response was, okay, that's fine if you marry her. He said, but where the hell are you taking her? And we then proceeded to catch a shark like 10 minutes later. And he said, yeah, you can get the hook out of that one's mouth. So essentially I then applied for this fellowship, got into Iran, and then asked if I could go to Pakistan instead, and had some clips from the Iranian trip, and had probably published a half a dozen stories when I was in Central Asia. And then this fellowship that sent me to Pakistan, the Institute of Current World Affairs, their whole thing is to go somewhere for 2 years, learn the local language, and ideally, you know, don't get kicked out.
Yeah.
Don't sort of abridge your experience, and just write about what you see. So as a aspiring foreign correspondent, this is like the coolest thing ever. And so I moved there on Valentine's Day of 2006. My wife came about a month later, and we were just there for this very pivotal period in Pakistani modern history, and a great period for reporting because Pakistani Taliban were beginning to coalesce and beginning to become something, but they were also still making a public appeal that they were just offering a sort of more righteous and virtuous style of government than the one being offered by this American poodle, Pervez Musharraf, as they, you know, considered him. So they were interested in media, and they were interested in talking, and they weren't as hidebound as they are now. They weren't as scary as they are now. And so it was a great, you know, it was a great asset to be able to get out and to talk to people all over the country.
Now, you're the first person, you're not the first correspondent from Pakistan I have interviewed, but you're the first who went as a married duo. What does your wife do?
So my wife, she was a nutritionist. So we went, and she's also an artist. So she spent the first couple of months, walking around, taking pictures, drawing, being inspired, just kind of hanging out, and then started getting a little stir crazy. So she decided to enroll at the International Islamic University in Islamabad, and she became the first non-Muslim American to ever go to school there. And she's enrolled in a master's program and would put on a hijab every morning and go to school. And the classes were sort of taught in a mixture. The classes were ostensibly in English, but not everyone's English was that good. So the classes were in Urdu and English. And so she learned international relations from, this Islamist women's education. So, I mean, she has this great story. On the first day of one of the classes, the professor said, you know, what is absolute sovereignty, or who has absolute sovereignty?
Yeah.
And girls started raising their hand, and it was Allah. And then the professor said, no, that's not what I'm looking for. He's obviously looking for the state here, but it wasn't coming. And so Ricky said that, you know, he asked a half a dozen people before he finally said, no, it's not Allah, it's actually the state. I know where you're coming from. But so that was, you know, that was the kind of worldview. Every one of our journalist friends tried to get her to write a book.
I was going
to
say, they make it amazing, like what they really teach at Islamabad International Relations School.
I mean, her Arabic teacher would not tutor my wife. My wife needed Arabic to graduate, and he refused to tutor her because it would be scandalous if he were caught after class hours privately one-on-one with a foreign student, female student. I mean, so my wife's Urdu teacher, who also spoke a little bit of Arabic, would call the Arabic teacher, ask the Arabic teacher what the lesson was. He would then tell my wife's Urdu teacher, who would then teach my wife. I mean, it was just unbelievable.
And there aren't female professors then, I take it, at the university.
There were some, but in this particular instance, it was male. So she was doing that. She was also, with her nutrition background, she was a head nutritionist and at the Serena Hotel, which is this lovely 5-star hotel in Islamabad. We had no money, but she swapped her services for gym memberships for both of us. That also gave her some great contacts, because there were a number of obese Pakistani men who wanted nothing more than to be sort of told what they should eat by some blonde Jersey girl.
This seems like another book.
So that's the other book. So then in the end, and this is why she was so bitter when we were deported, is that she, as a result of all these contacts, had started hosting a reality TV show and had just done a pilot for a reality TV show in Urdu in which she was making over Pakistani women. And so when the cops came in early January of 2008, you know, I hadn't been home in 2 years. Part of the stipulation of the fellowship was that I not go home. And
that's so they don't have to get you another visa? Or?
Well, it's just they just don't want, they want you to stay immersed.
They don't want you meeting with your CIA contacts. So what led to your deportation?
So I wrote this piece in the Times Magazine that came out in the first week of January of 08. And it was a story about the new generation of Taliban that were emerging, that were no longer beholden to the authority structures that fostered the first generation, the authority structures being the tribal authorities, the intelligence agencies, and so on.
The story is called The Education of a Holy Warrior, I believe.
Next Gen Taliban.
Next Gen Taliban. Yeah. Okay, that's a different one. And
it started out as a profile of this one Islamist pro-Taliban leader who had been called, you know, the father of the Afghan Taliban, who was now being threatened and rocket attacked by the Pakistani Taliban. So it was this sort of, there was this rupture. And in the process of reporting that, I spent some time in the Swat Valley where the Pakistani Taliban had taken over. And I, in October of 07, witnessed the Pakistani Taliban lashing criminals. And it was just, I mean, you talk about being someplace where you know you're not supposed to be.
Yeah.
And, you know, they knew that I was an American journalist, but I spoke enough Urdu to be able to not give myself away immediately. I was dyeing my hair brown. I had a little bit of a beard. I was wearing a shalwar kameez. I just sort of like threw as many clothes.
Yeah, off I was going to say, like, we had Matthew Akins on the podcast, and I think he's half Asian of some descent.
He can pass much better.
For those who are listening on the radio, you look like you could be like a Welsh rugby player, maybe. even with dyed hair, I have trouble believing that you would pass as Pakistani.
Well, the thing is, you know, part of the readjustment is that I had this. I had all Pakistani men wear sandals with a little bit of a heel, and of course, you know, when in Rome, so I had these awesome sandals that had a little bit of a heel, and that was one of the things when we got back to the States. My wife, we were unpacking our boxes. She said, "You will not wear those here."
So they got onto the fact that you were onto them a little bit, and I mean, do you know like directly what, you know, who said get rid of this guy?
No, I mean the situation was actually quite similar to what happened to Declan Walsh, the New York Times correspondent who was recently expelled. In that we were home one night, and a bunch of cops showed up, plainclothes police officers and uniformed police officers, and they just handed over this deportation order that said. I mean, it said that our visas had been canceled effective immediately. And, you know, I was stunned. It was 2 days after this Times Magazine piece had come out. The piece came out on a Sunday. On Monday, did the Pakistani government wake up and say, let's kick this kid out?
Yeah.
Had the gears already been in motion? I don't know.
Were they looking at the web version of the Times Magazine and had a few days of what was coming out? Possibly.
So this was my wife's contacts, you know, so these cops are all standing in the driveway, and I went running upstairs and I told my wife what was going on. And my wife was totally unperturbed. She said, oh, you know, call our friend who was one of her obese nutrition clients. And I called this guy when I ran back downstairs, and I called this guy in front of the cops, and I said, you know, we have a bit of a problem right now. I've got police officers in my driveway who are ready to take us to the airport right now. And he said, don't worry about it. He said, I'm playing bridge right now with President Musharraf's national security advisor. He said, you pass the phone to the senior-most police officer, and I'll pass the phone to Tariq Aziz, the national security advisor. So we did this phone swap, and the look on this police officer's face will ever be in my mind when I said, you know, Tariq Aziz is on the phone and wants to talk to you. And a few sort of yes-sirs later, the guy gave me back the phone and said, okay, you guys are fine. We're sorry for bothering you tonight. The next morning, we called my wife's nutrition client again, and you know, and he said, we'll deal with this in the morning. Just go to sleep and don't worry about it. So in the morning, we called him, and he said, this is above everybody, and you know, they'll give you 3 days to leave, but you need to leave. So,
and I mean, were you envisioning a life in Pakistan at that point? Were you planning to stay?
We didn't know what we were. I mean, we were going to stay for a while because my wife had all these great opportunities lined up. In fact, part of this is what really, really gets her, is that she had just, the hotel was just about to expand and was going to put in this huge spa, and they had just made her she'd gone from being an unpaid nutrition counselor to being a fully paid spa manager. And her first
job. I could have had a spa in Islamabad.
Well, this hotel is pretty magnificent. And they said to her this summer, what would have been the spring of 2008, we want you to go around to various 5-star hotels in Asia and just enjoy treatments for several days and figure out what's the best way to do it. So she was pissed at me. I mean,
it seems like your wife really got like a better deal in Pakistan. You were watching the Taliban whip guys and she was about to go on the spa tour.
Yeah. She was not happy with me when we brought her back to DC, and she was like, well, what do I do now?
Can you ever go back to Pakistan?
So I went back. There was a government change, and I went back in August of 2008, 7 months later, for Smithsonian to do this sort of culture story about Sufism, with the idea that the Taliban have the guns, but the Sufis are the ones. The Sufis have the numbers, and if you want to understand mainstream Islam in Pakistan, that these Sufi festivals are really what you need to go and see. So I went, and the magazine, the Smithsonian, sent along a photographer, this great guy, Aaron Huey, who's just a wild man. And so Aaron brought his wife along as well, and the three of us were in a taxi leaving Karachi to go attend this festival, and we started getting these very disturbing phone calls from people claiming to be people that didn't exist, newspaper reporters that didn't exist, all of them asking to meet me at various places in Karachi. And I was like, you know, I've sort of tried to extract lessons and read enough about the Daniel Pearl case to know kind of what happened in the days leading up and the hours leading up. And this is very similar.
They were asking you to meet, saying they were Pakistani journalists?
So this one guy called and said he was from, I forget what newspaper, but that he wanted to interview me and he heard that I was in town. And so we proceeded to call his editor, and his editor said, there's no reporter by that name at this newspaper.
Did you stay in the country after?
Well, we kept driving towards this festival. And then shortly after that, friends started calling and they were watching local television, and it was being reported that Nicholas Shamble, editor of Smithsonian Magazine, has been kidnapped. And it was like, all right, I get the hint. You know,
I'm flattered that you would call me the editor of Smithsonian Magazine.
Yeah, and while my last name is not Shamble, it's close enough, and I get it. So over the course of the next couple of hours, the name and the ID became more accurate, and before we knew it, it was Nicholas Schmidl, a writer for Smithsonian, has been kidnapped. State Department called my wife. She called me in a frenzy and said, you know, I just got this call from the State Department. Where are you, and are you okay? And I said, I am, but like, I'm trying to get to this festival, do what I need to do, and then get to the airport immediately.
You stayed at the festival, even knowing that you had already been kidnapped under a different name.
So this is Pakistan. I mean, this was the smallness of Pakistan, was that the night before, the 2 days before, President Musharraf had stepped down, and Asif Zardari suddenly became the most powerful person in the country. And on that night, I sat with Zardari for about 45 minutes. And so when this all started happening, we called Zardari's office and we said, you know, remember me, the guy who was reporting or profiling you last night?
Yeah.
Things have just gone belly up, and, you know, like, we just need to do this we need to go to this festival for a little bit and then get to the airport. So he called the chief minister of the province and they set up a little bit of a security, you know, they essentially escorted us to this festival.
Right.
And then escorted us back to Karachi. And when we got back to Karachi, it was just, things just became, we'd been driving all night. To describe this night, you would think that I'm making some part of it up. We literally were driving through the middle of Sindh, which is sort of bandit country, and we cracked an axle. And then, we had to drive the rest of the way at like 20 miles an hour. We didn't get to a hotel. We rolled into Karachi at like 6 a.m. And the Karachi police, who a day earlier had said they wanted to help us, and then when we got back into town, they would take care of us, now said that they didn't want anything to do with us. And so it just felt like someone had gotten to them and sort of told them, like, don't help these kids. And so eventually I called the embassy, the U.S. embassy, and had what was more or less the first time that I'd ever asked the embassy for help. And they told us that they knew that the intelligence agencies were following us, but they couldn't tell whether the intelligence agencies were trying to protect us from a threat or whether they were the threat.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, isn't it probably the intelligence agency? Like, who else knew that you were coming to the country so that they could get Shamble on there in the first place?
Right. The whole thing was was it got fairly terrifying.
Yeah.
And so they said the embassy said get to a hotel, get to this 5-star hotel, the Pearl Continental, and get a room and just stay there.
Get in the spa.
And so we got into a hotel. Someone from the embassy showed up a little bit later and put me in a bulletproof car and took me to the airport. And if you get taken, if you're trying to report in a country that's not quite a war zone and you have to be taken by the U.S. embassy in a bulletproof car, that's when my reporting there is done.
In terms of developing those sort of reportorial instincts, how do you know when you're somewhere that's too dangerous? I mean, where were you drawing the lines?
I think that in the end, if I needed to, sort of be traveling around in a bulletproof car, it was terrifying. And the photographer Aaron Huey and I have talked about it since then. And I think that he joked that he aged years over the course of those 2 days. I think that now, particularly, the way that I approach stories is much different. It's much more about trying to really minimize and calculate risk. I think that initially you want to throw yourself in places that no one else is, to be in the middle of a Pakistani, what was effectively a training camp. That's a way to grab an editor's attention. And I feel like now, I'll let other people sort of, do that. I'd rather now find stories of people that are doing crazy stuff than be the one that necessarily needs to go about trying to
do it. Well, it was interesting reading through your stories. This is kind of a good transition to some of the stuff you had more modern. Many of your early stories read more like travelogue and have like a lot of I in it and are basically you putting yourself in a situation you don't really know what's going to happen and something happens or you observe things. And your reporting has shifted to a far more narrative mode where you've sort of stepped out of the picture and you're going after stories. When do you make that shift?
I went to do a story, which was potentially the diciest story that I've done since I left Pakistan, but it was also, I think, a transition story. I went to, for the Times Magazine, sent me to Nigeria to do a story about the kidnap for ransom industry. And I spent some time in the Niger Delta with a couple of kidnappers. And it was kind of a profile of a kidnapper and, just listening to this guy talk about taking, foreign contractors off the streets and, holding them at gunpoint, and taking them into the creeks and then the ransom negotiations and all that. And I think that, so there was an element of like, look, I'm here hanging out with the Nigerian, with the kidnappers, but also these are incredible stories and sort of, met this Scottish guy who walked me through his whole kidnapping ordeal. And I think that at that point was kind of the transition that I don't need to be, again, like I don't need to be the one that's getting kidnapped to make it a good story.
So not that long after that, you became a staff writer for The New Yorker. So your staff.
Yeah.
And you did this story on the Bin Laden raid, which is probably the most well-known or the most talked about work that you've done. How did you get that story? For starters, because you weren't the established U.S. military beat guy at that point.
No.
What led to you picking up that story?
Yeah, so you'd asked earlier about hanging out with intelligence folks in Pakistan, and I did not there. But when I came back, I did a bunch of think tank panels about Pakistani Taliban, and I did a thing at the Council on Foreign Relations one morning, and it was... Bob Grenier, who the former CIA station chief in Pakistan and head of the Counterterrorism Center, and I were on this panel together. And, Grenier had been out of Pakistan for a while, but we started talking. So he was, far rustier than I. And then I'm sure his knowledge on Pakistani Taliban leaders is far deeper than mine in some regards. But nonetheless, we were talking about these one or two individuals. And I just kind of explained to him, he said that they were brothers, and I then said, no, actually they're related by like this cousin. And it was one of the, and it felt really good for the second. And afterwards, when the thing broke up, someone approached me and said, that was pretty impressive. You kind of showed up the former CIA station chief in terms of your Pakistani Taliban knowledge. And, so I stayed in touch with this guy.
Now you've crossed Pakistani intelligence and U.S.
No, Grenier and I, Bob and I stayed in touch for sure. And, He, in fact, kind of has helped me on a number of other stories and kind of was working in the private security realm.
Now, I know that Patrick Radden Keefe actually worked for one of these sort of governmental think tank like agencies for a year or two. Like, well, he was recruited. They were like, "You're so good at this. Like, why don't you actually do this?"
Yeah, he was at the Department of Defense in the in their transnational threats office, I think, for a while.
It's a good name for a band. So, has anyone ever asked you to do something like that?
No, they haven't.
You can't talk about it.
No, I haven't. I'm trying to think whether there's been any. No, I mean, people have asked to sort of come and talk at events where there's this hybrid of private industry and intelligence community, and I've just steered clear and kind of realized that there's always the trade off of exposure by hanging around with these people,
yeah,
versus the association that later on somehow or another diminishes your perspective of your credibility or independence. And so I've just kind of taken the stance of steering clear.
Evan speaks at a lot of corporate conferences. He did a story about how to disappear from hire. That's apparently something lots of businessmen are interested in. So you showed up the CIA former station chief, and this was what, around what year?
This was early 2008.
And
met this guy who I stayed in contact with and would periodically meet for lunch. I mean, he was and remains a friend. I mean, he's much more a friend than a source. And we would just kind of get together and shoot the breeze. And in May of 2011, we met for lunch. And it was clear that he may be able to point me in the right direction on the story in a way that and offer some granularity.
How much after the actual events was this?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Okay.
So we met.
Did you tell him that you were thinking about doing the story? He was just like, "Hey, I was just having lunch with the SEAL team. We should all go bowling."
So when you, and this is the first time that I felt like I had something like a scoop, and so then the question that I, you know, reached out to all these people who I respected and kind of had seen as mentors, the Steve Calls of this world, you know, kind of like, what do I do with this scoop? Like, how do I go about trying to verify and add to it? And, it's, you know, the White House was the last stop. But along the way, when I would bring this story to various government agencies and tell them what I knew, they then were willing to corroborate. And also there's this kind of, you know, you're also pricking their pride a little bit. Like they think they have the whole story, and suddenly you come to them and they're like, "Oh, so you do, so you know about X, Y, and Z. Well, like, I bet you don't know about A, B, and C." And I'm like, "No, I don't. But now I'll write that down."
And when you're going off to these people who obviously are not going to be quoted in the story, what kind of a protection? I mean, is there a sort of a New Yorker policy about deep military sourcing? How do you do that for the first time, I guess I'm asking?
Well, like I said, I mean, it helped to ask someone like Steve Call, who has both the military, New Yorker, all the background, to kind of get him to get some thoughts. But you know, there wasn't a lot of I mean, I remember when I filed the piece, David Remnick called later, you know, a few hours later, and said, "Okay, so the rules of the road, the way we do things in the magazine is that we're going to really fact check this thing. So I hope your guys are ready to get on the phone." And I said, "Well, the good news is that everybody is, and everyone's prepared." But I think that at when you go to them with so much, when you go to people from whether it's the CIA or SOCOM or JSOC with the core of a story, and all really you need to do, you know, is you're telling them. They're either saying yes or they're nodding with a smile or they're saying, "I can't really comment on this." And I'm saying, "Okay, well, just tell me when I go astray."
Yeah.
And people would. And people would say, "Actually, you know, there were X number of helicopters." Did you know that there was one episode where they said, "I bet you didn't know that the helicopters had to stop to refuel on the way home." And I said, "No, I didn't." And then, so, you know, I would go back to the original source and say, "Oh, yeah, you know, it wasn't like," then he would be able to describe more on that. So it was just this circular reporting where with each series of conversations, whether they were from the Pentagon or from, like I said, the agency, the White House, my original source, I could just keep coming back and my original source would then corroborate and give me a little bit more. You know, people, their memories are jogged. Even though this is a relatively fresh incident, it takes half a dozen conversations at least to feel like you can flesh out, you know, begin to flesh out a story like this.
Are the people who are telling you this stuff for the story aware of who else is telling you stuff for the story? I mean, how much are you shielding the different players from each other?
Very much so. Yeah.
So you might, like, two people who work together potentially could be both talking to you and unaware that they're both talking to you.
Yeah.
Did you catch anyone bullshitting you?
There was a question about the discrepancy. There were two issues, one of which is that whether it was a capture or kill mission.
That was, damn, kill my next question. Okay,
and,
go ahead.
And the White House was adamant that it was a capture or kill mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just kept going back to my source, and he just kept saying, look, they can call it what they want, but there was no way we were taking him out alive.
Because I believe you were the first person who reported sort of definitively in a fact-check way that it was a kill mission.
Yeah.
And I noticed that when I read it originally. When I was reading your piece, I was like, huh, that's weird, because it's still being widely reported that it was a capture mission that ended up in a kill.
Yeah.
So something like that, the fact that the White House is saying no is not a problem for a fact checker.
Well, I think that next time we should bring in the team, and that'll be, you know, but
that would be awesome. Actually, I want to have a New Yorker fact checker in here. I think it'd be fascinating, because this is not an uncommon issue with the stories like this. It's like, wait, how did this get assembled? And we've never had a fact checker on the show.
So yeah. Next time. No, I mean, I think that it is amazing to see them do that. I mean, they in this most recent story were finding people and pulling people out of the woodwork that I just hadn't been able to get. I mean, it's one thing to say, can I interview you? It's another thing to say, the story's going to print tomorrow, and I know you haven't wanted to speak to the writer for the past 4 months, but your name is associated with the following things, and will you confirm this? So you know, they do work their magic in that sense. But in the question of the capture or kill, in the capture or kill question, you also wonder why when someone who I trust as a friend is telling me so adamantly that there was no capture option. And then there are folks at the White House who are telling me it was a capture or kill mission. You have to ask yourself why they would want, what would be their reasoning for that? And I think that ultimately we felt like that was spin, and the other one was the real deal. So we went with that.
Well, I mean, it doesn't really make sense particularly that it was that there was any intention to capture, because it seems like they're in a pretty good place to have captured him if that was actually the intention of the mission.
Yeah, and it depending on which version of the actual sort of bullet, the kill bullet you take, I mean, there are versions that, you know, my version and the way that we reported it is that, you know, there was a bullet to the head and a bullet to the chest. And then Mark Owen, who was the SEAL on the team, said that, you know, essentially Bin Laden had been shot once, and he came and pumped him with a couple more shots. And then another guy who claims that he was also the shooter offered a slightly different account. So that's, in light of those two accounts, I thought, all right, well, so if we've got two guys who are both saying they're the shooter, then my initial thought after the piece, which is that as these SEALs start coming out and offering first-hand accounts, we'll get even more clarity and detail and granularity about the story. As each of them have come out and their reports have actually contradicted one another, I think, all right, you know, I'm pretty darn confident with what we've got. So, you know, there are 23 guys in a dark house that they've never been in there before and are about to kill Osama bin Laden. You know, it's not surprising that their accounts would that everyone would not have the exact same memory of that night.
Yeah. Do you, in seeing the events now sort of become a part of pop culture, both in movies like Zero Dark 30, I watched, there's a documentary on HBO right now called Manhunt,
which is
more about the sort of hunt for bin Laden than the actual raid. But
what's
that like for you as someone who is sort of, you know, what's it like for someone whose research has sort of contributed to the historical record of these events, seeing it variously fictionalized and presented in a nonfiction context with different sourcing?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I don't feel much ownership of it. I think that I think I was really ready after the story and the sort of ensuing brouhaha after the story.
Yeah.
I was really ready to kind of jump into another, to jump back into this court-martial story and kind of get back to work and not have this single piece of reporting kind of define, you know, my contribution.
Have you been consulted for any people who are doing Prime? Are you like a Bin Laden expert at this point? Or?
You know, there was a lot of talk initially about consulting on movies. And in fact, on zero of them was I actually formally consulted.
Well, thank you very much for coming in on very short notice.
It's been fun.
Yeah, it's been great. And I look forward to these stories that will keep coming out.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Nicholas Schmidl, you can check out, I think maybe it's two New Yorkers ago in the Crosshairs.
Yeah.
You can find all this online. And most of these other stories are on your website, which we will link to in the show notes. And that was the Long Form Podcast. Thanks very much to our super editor, Lauren Kirchner, my co-hosts, Max Linsky, Evan Ratliff, our intern, Chelsea Edgar, and everybody around the office who put up with us constructing this awesome podcast studio. We'll be back next week.